Welcome to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by the Rebeller Podcast Network. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, the editor-in-chief of Rebeller. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you guys today?
Fine.
Just fine.
Happy Friday, y'all.
Yeah. Before we get started on this week's show, I want to tell you guys a bit about RebellerMedia.com. RebellerMedia.com is a one-stop shop for all your film writing needs. Every day, I and my crack team of editors will be gathering the most interesting movie news and essays on the web for you to browse through. Think of us a bit like the Drudge Report for Hollywood. And then after you're done with that, check out some of our originals. Check out S. Craig Zoller's discussion of his favorite graphic novels, or Once Upon a Time in Hollywood editor Fred Raskin's tribute to Sally Menke. We are paying good money for the content you're enjoying, including the content you're enjoying right now. And we hope you'll sign up for a membership. For a limited time, you can lock in our introductory annual rate, $20.19, for the next 100 years. That's right. For the next century, your subscription rate will never go up. Ever. As the editor-in-chief of Rebeller, that's my promise to you. I will honor it even when I am 137. That's 100 years from now, if you couldn't figure that out. And now, on to the show. First up is Controversies and Nontroversies, a segment in which we weigh in on the day's hot-button issues and decide if they're worth getting agitated about or not. This week's row involved the cancellation of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood's Chinese release, reportedly because Shannon Lee, Bruce Lee's daughter, complained about the film to Chinese censors. The film, you remember, has fallen afoul of progressive viewers for a variety of reasons, among them that Margot Robbie did not have enough lines as Sharon Tate, and that the film's leads casually refer to Mexicans as, quote, beaners. Now, the most troubling scene of all, according to some, was the fact that a mere stuntman could fight a cocky, smack-talking Bruce Lee to a standstill. And that transgression against progressive principles might have been what got it canceled in China. At least this is what it seems like from what I would assume are Quentin Tarantino's people talking to The Hollywood Reporter. That said, Alyssa, isn't this the future that liberals want?
My eyes are just circulating in my head so quickly that I'm pretty sure my skull is going to explode.
That would make a great scene in a Quentin Tarantino movie.
Would. It's true. I cannot describe how much I hate anything that puts me on the same side of an issue as Mike Pence, but this is like a flames on the side of my face story for me, because there is no world in which it is a good thing for liberals to have ideals that are theoretically ours. And I don't know that the idea that, like, nobody can beat Bruce Lee is, like, a tenet of the progressive canon. But there is no world in which it makes any sense at all for us to get in bed with the Chinese government. Like, just none. It makes no sense at all. And so, whether or not you agree with any of the progressive critiques of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the idea of asking a government that has interned a million Uyghurs to enforce our ideas is the dumbest, most counterproductive thing, and it just makes me want to quit everything. I am so angry.
So this is Alyssa's fault. Alyssa's taking responsibility for this because she, as the doyen of progressive film and TV criticism, I think we're going to have to lay this one
I mean,
at your feet.
So, like, is my penance that I have to go, like, join Concerned Women for America or
You have
something?
To join Falun Gong now, I think. That's actually, we'll get to that
actually,
in a minute,
I mean,
actually.
Joining Falun Gong seems like it would be kind of awesome. Like, it's basically Tai Chi and meditation.
It's just meditation.
Stuff. Like,
yeah.
I'm into that. Like,
minor organ risk.
That.
Peter, what's your take on this? As the committed capitalist on the show, I assume that you are opposed to efforts by the government to straight up censor speech for bad thinking.
I think that's probably what's happening here. So it's worth noting that the Chinese government has not stated an official reason why they revoked permission.
Because their censor board is so transparent and clear.
Right. And so not that they're usually clear, but we don't know exactly why. And in fact, there's an article in LA Magazine sort of speculating that it's not maybe just the Bruce Lee stuff, although that may be the primary issue, but also just that it's sort of part of the climate of kind of tense relationships right now between American entertainment companies and the Chinese government. And you can think about what's been going on with the NBA and with some of this stuff with Blizzard, a video game maker that revoked, that took money from a game champion for speaking out in favor of Hong Kong's protesters. They eventually reversed that decision partially. Anyway, it's a tense and complicated time right now for the Chinese government with the Hong Kong protests, and American media companies are caught up in the middle of that. And it, in some ways, it does put them in a little bit of a tough position because the Chinese market is huge. It's more than a billion people, certainly for movies. They want to have access to that. Now, I do not support the Chinese government in its desire to censor films and its desire to, so they censor both in soft and hard ways, right? Mm. They both say you have to recut the film sometimes, but they also will not actually tell movie companies that they have to do something. What they do is they limit the number of foreign films that can come in. I think it's 25 or 30. I forget the exact number, but it's around 25 or 30 films that can play in China that aren't Chinese originals.
And they control the release dates. They actually say you have to release it on this day.
And then what they say, and then they don't say you have to meet these criteria or anything. What that does is it sort of sets up a competition amongst studios, amongst filmmakers, to make films that they believe will either not offend or actively make the Chinese government happy. And so the Chinese government plays both a soft and, in this case, I think, is trying to play sort of an even stronger role in changing the content of American films. I think it's really it's a real problem for Hollywood. It's a real problem for filmmakers. I am glad to see that Quentin Tarantino's has decided to stand up and say, nope, I'm going to exercise my contractual right as a filmmaker who has final cut on this film not to change a frame for the Chinese government. What he is going to do, and I think this is also great, he's going to change frames for the United States audience. He's going to re-release the movie with 10 extra minutes, and I'm excited to see it again.
I am also excited to see it. It's interesting that you mentioned the soft power, because I just started listening to Bob Iger's memoir-ish rules for business leadership book, whatever. And in the introduction, he has this really just awful, weak-kneed bit about working with the Chinese government. And we want to make sure that we are exporting Disney but not engaging in cultural imperialism. And I was just like standing there on the elliptical, doing my thing and getting sick listening to it, because I was like, this disgusts me as an American and as like a defender of capitalism and foreign capitalism and globalism and all that. I listen to this and I think this is capitulation. This is America accepting the tenets of China, as opposed to Alyssa, as you have argued, the ability of America to export its ideals, right?
And this is an argument that all forms of American entertainment companies make all of the time. The NBA talks about exporting American values overseas. Hollywood spends half of the Oscars just sort of praising itself for exporting tolerance and diversity and peace, love, and understanding abroad. And if you are capitulating to an obviously increasingly dictatorial government to get market share, that is just the rankest hypocrisy. And I think it's worth noting that some of the ways that entertainment companies kiss up to Chinese censors and Chinese businesses don't end up serving Chinese audiences well either. I mean, when Iron Man 3 came out, there was extra footage shot for the movie's release in China. And this is another part of the sort of soft censorship stuff, where there are a couple of Chinese surgeons who like drink some Chinese energy drink in a bit of product placement and talk about how like they have to save Iron Man for like the good of China's surgical reputation. And Chinese audiences thought this was ridiculous. And it's obviously ridiculous. It is, pandering is maybe not the same thing as imperialism, but it's not like Chinese audiences don't notice the pandering, Mm-hmm. And so, it's just, it is what is good for the Chinese government and the Chinese censor board, and what is good for American companies is not what's good for American values or for Chinese consumers mm-hmm. either. Mm. And so, it would be one thing if this was sort of a genuine difference in tastes that American movie companies were trying to figure out how to accommodate, right? I mean, if you are trying to make movies that are just sort of more universally understandable and less culturally specific, like, maybe that's defensible to a certain extent. But, you know, just the combination of, you know, toadying cheesiness is so gross.
Yeah.
So I want to defend companies and capitalism just a little bit here. Look, I think it's a good thing that American films are playing in China. And I think it is, and I would rather have a world in which American films play in China.
Good for who? Good in what sense?
It's good for American moviegoers. It's good for Americans.
How is it good for American moviegoers?
Because
in what sense is it good for American moviegoers to have their taste shaped to the lowest common Chinese denominator?
Or the lowest common Chinese censors denominator.
Yeah.
So, I mean, American moviegoers love a lot of the same movies that that play well in China. The Fast and the Furious series, Marvel films.
Don't need more of those.
The Disney movies.
Don't need more of those.
I mean, I know you don't think we need more of them, but in fact, American moviegoers love that stuff. And this is in fact one of the reasons why corporations have been somewhat weak when it comes to standing up to China, is that there doesn't appear to be a big market in America for standing up for American values in China, right? Mm. And so imagine a world in which there were boycotts, rarely work, but there are moments in which in which markets change, in which sort of people expect corporations to do certain things. And if American moviegoers said, I'm not going to go see Disney movies anymore if they keep putting in stupid scenes in Iron Man 3, or more likely if they said stuff like, actually, you can't make Tilda Swinton play the Ancient One to appease Chinese censors. This is basically a thing that happened. Actually, a thing that I actually found out that I didn't know about was that the Freddie Mercury movie, all the references to his homosexuality were removed for the Chinese audience. And if American moviegoers said, "Look, we're not going to go see this movie if we know that you're doing that," American moviegoers could change what Hollywood studios are doing, but there just isn't a huge market for it. But look, I think that trade overall with China and bringing China into the global economy has been a very good thing for American consumers, for the global economy, for Chinese citizens. It has made many, 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 many people in both China and America richer and better off. And yes, there are costs to this. In no way do I support Chinese censorship. I think it's bad. I think Quentin Tarantino is doing the right thing here. But it is kind of complicated. And like there's a movement, particularly on the right. So this isn't Elizabeth's fault. This might be your fault, Sonny.
Oh, it's probably my fault.
Your fault. And I'm going to blame you here. There is a kind of an argument that we are seeing right now on the right that I really disagree with, which is that, well, China is exercising a sort of censorious power over American entertainment. Therefore, they're our global enemy, and we shouldn't trade with them, and we should ramp up aggression.
They're 100% our global enemy. They're a competitor and a rival, and that's different, man. The idea that China is not a global... We may be splitting hairs over the difference between rival and enemy. As the believer in a unipolar American-dominated world, rivals are just as bad as enemies. They need to be crushed just as hardly. And you know, I'll leave it to the American manufacturer who is at home, you know, shooting up his opioids because he lost his job to the Chinese businessman stealing his factories. To see if he has a problem with it. I will say, two cheers for American capitalism. I'm mostly on your side on this, frankly. Two cheers for American capitalism, but three cheers for Quentin Tarantino, American capitalist. He is leaving at least fives, probably tens of millions of dollars on the table.
I mean, personal money. I mean, the amount of money that they make.
Yeah.
He gets points off of what he would be making in China. He has a lot of first dollar points. There's $50 or $100 million in box office he is personally choosing to make himself much less rich.
So I do think an interesting question, though, is what the Chinese audience for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is. It's not particularly clear to me, and because of the limit on the number of American movies that can play in China, we don't necessarily have the best market-driven sense that we might have otherwise of what the overlap between American and Chinese tastes are. I think we can agree that all people in the globe should be have the chance to live in the light of God Emperor Dwayne Johnson. The question is, at what cost?
So the question here is the cancellation of Once Upon a Time in China a controversy or a non-troversy? Alyssa.
It's obviously a controversy.
Obviously a controversy. Peter.
Totally a controversy.
Totally a controversy. Absolutely a controversy. Controversy. All right. Now we're on to the main attraction. Speaking of global capitalism, Netflix released The Laundromat this week on TVs. It's been in a few theaters for a while, a few weeks before this, but it's finally on all of your TVs. You can go home and watch it right now. You can turn off this podcast. Go ahead. We've already got your download. And watch it right now and then come back. I'll wait. Okay, go ahead. It's Steven Soderbergh's broadside against the global finance industry as represented by Mossack Fonseca, a company that basically just built other companies to hide still other companies to create a massive, impenetrable paper trail that allowed them to steal lots and lots of money. It's all shells, as one character in the movie puts it. Part The Big Short, part Aaron Brockovich, the film is almost an experimental feature in certain ways. It plays with POV and the fourth wall like my daughter plays with Paw Patrol figurines. There's a curious detour near the end that doesn't frankly make a great deal of sense and is at least a little bit hypocritical. We can talk about that in 1 second. But aside from that, Peter, it seems to me that there's something for all sides of the political aisle to agree with from this film, if not from the movie-making aisle. Do you agree or disagree?
I found myself not agreeing with very much from this film. I really... it's an interesting experiment, as all of Steven Soderbergh's experimental films tend to be, but I think it's a failed one, and it really kind of it makes poor use of a really excellent cast. It's not very focused in terms of the way of its criticism of capitalism, of weirdly of campaign finance law.
Well, this is the weird digression
bizarre,
at the end.
Bizarre epilogue in which, like, so I don't know if you guys studied Bertolt Brecht, the kind of communist playwright in college. Or,
going Brechtian
on
us.
Yeah, so I mean, I read a lot of Brecht in college. And Brecht's whole, he was not just a playwright, he was
the
also
the most Suderman thing I've ever heard.
He was also a theorist of the theater. And his argument, his kind of fundamental argument for theater was that it should have a distancing effect. It should break down the artifice, right? It should not attempt to be realistic. And so it should create a space between the viewer and the production so that they understand that what they're seeing is actually an argument. And part of what he would say is that plays should be like two lawyers arguing on a stage, and viewers, you know, or should leave moved to action. And this is just a total like Brechtian film. It is absolutely Bertolt Brecht, except it doesn't work as well as Brecht's best
stuff.
Well,
it's Brecht by way of Adam McKay, yeah. Right? And Soderbergh is one of my favorite American filmmakers.
McKay does the Brecht thing better.
Yes, I think that's completely right.
Yes, and partially...
It's not nearly as good as The Big Short.
Yeah, indeed. And yeah, it's... I mean, I love Steven Soderbergh. I quite enjoy Adam McKay. The combination... Like, Soderbergh doing McKay drag just felt really weird, in part because... I mean, it's a combination of those two things plus like a dose of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. It's a very strange movie. I mean, it's almost better described as a short story collection than anything else.
It definitely feels it's episodic by nature. It is. Yeah. So the way the film is structured, if you haven't seen it, is it features Antonio Banderas and Gary Oldman as the heads of Mossack Fonseca. They basically are taking us through a brief history of money, what money is, how it is used. And they're
kind of great with really bad material.
They're chewing scenery very hard. It is, and they have these fantastic costumes, and the set design is great.
It's worth like a little footnote here to talk about, just to note, how good they are with bad material and how much it shows how much actors matter.
Yes.
Like, those roles could have been awful. And they somehow or another, like, those scenes are actually some of the most entertaining scenes in the movie, though they're not written all that well.
And while people acknowledge, I mean, I think Gary Oldman is universally acknowledged as one of the greatest actors working today, Antonio Banderas is also a fantastic actor who I think rarely gets recognized for how good he is. And, you know, he was one of those actors who in the 90s could do, like, anything. I mean, I don't know if you guys are massive Zorro people. I 100% am. It's a great movie. But that should have been...
Are there Mask of Zorro people? Is there like a is there like a cult for Mask of Zorro?
There are.
Okay.
I only recently discovered this, but there are. And I didn't know Alyssa was one. This is an unmasking.
Yeah, well, it's one of the great... I mean, it's part of a series of just like great grown-up romantic movies that aren't made anymore. But anyway, Banderas should have been just a huge star and is not. And seeing him with Gary Oldman in this movie is just really pleasurable, if only because, like, you see how worthy a scene partner he is for someone who is recognized in a way that he is not.
Now, this is... All right, so this is why I suggested there was kind of something for everyone here. Even if you don't love the movie, and even if you think the bit at the end, which, again, we'll get to, is a mess, I do think there is something here that should appeal, I think, to critics of capitalism writ large, who could say, like, this is what capitalism is. It's the meek being trod upon by the strong. The, you know, the system is designed. But it is also a representation of what a perversion of capitalism we kind of live in right now, right? Like, as the Reason magazine member of the podcast, Peter, I watch that and I think, boy, this is really a great demonstration of, like, why Trump has some appeal to people. Because you have the whole film is structured around this woman in Michigan.
I don't think it's a great demonstration.
Well, no,
it attempts to be a great demonstration, but I think it's working on that level.
Because, I mean, look, the film is about the film, in addition to these scenes with Gary Oldman and Antonio Banderas, is structured around this woman whose husband dies in a, like, duck boat mishap. Basically, it's one of these, like, you know, tragic things in the middle of Lake Michigan or wherever. Boat capsizes, her husband dies. And instead of getting a massive payout from the insurance company like she was supposed to, they find out that the insurance company is a shell for another shell company. It's another front. It's fronts all the way down. And people are just being taken advantage of, and money is being siphoned into these offshore accounts. And the little guy loses while the big guy, you know, does a couple months in prison after everything gets exposed. I mean, I was watching this and I was like, this feels a little bit Trumpy. This feels a little bit Trumpy.
I don't think that's wrong. I don't think it's a very effective demonstration of what it of. It doesn't make its own argument very well.
Mm-hmm.
So at the sort of front companies all the way down thing, it tries to combine with an argument against tax avoidance.
And it talks about
well, tax evasion is illegal. Tax avoidance is not, and tax avoidance is just structuring your finances so that you can pay less taxes legally. And they talk about sort of setting up companies in Delaware. Probably the best single line in the movie is where Gary Oldman and Banderas talk about how the writer of this movie has one, and the director of the movie has five of these companies set up in Delaware so that they don't have to pay as much in taxes. But the issue, the actual reason that Meryl Streep's character couldn't get a payout isn't tax avoidance. Tax avoidance is legal and fine. Everybody has a right to pay as little taxes as they legally can manage to pay. That's a right.
Like, sure,
if you are following the law, you're following the law. That's it. Instead, they kind of gloss over it. Like, that's what Meryl Streep's character was facing was fraud.
Fraud,
which no libertarian is like, actually, fraud is just fine, you know?
I bet I could find one.
No, fraud and defrauding people and sort of making promises that you don't live up to in a contract is fundamentally what we are opposed to.
Yes, yes.
And that's a thing that they basically just leave out, is that she got hit, or her character got hit with a fraudulent accounting scheme. And then they try to kind of tie this to tax avoidance, and it doesn't really work, especially when at the end they just sort of drift off into campaign finance reform, they pull a
complete 180, and it's like, by the way, this is all about campaign finance. From Alyssa, what were your thoughts on that? Because when I was watching this last night, I was like, what the hell is going on?
It's interesting because it actually felt like a nod to me to the end of Angels in America, which Meryl Streep also famously
and which started. You love.
Yes. I love Angels in America so much that I once followed Tony Kushner down a dark street, tapped him on the shoulder, and then burst into tears. This is not a story I tell. That's... to like,
oh, my good Lord.
He was so lovely about it, and I'm so embarrassed.
That's like a scene from a Tony Kushner screenplay.
Or like an Aaron Sorkin screenplay, honestly.
Either way.
It's a bit much.
Either way, yes. Well, I mean, I am a bit much. But which has another sort of, you know, fourth wall breaking moment like that turn to the audience. But it's really well written and, you know, just really brings together everything that came before in this really just beautiful and moving way. And, you know, again, Meryl Streep is... in the movie, she is the widow who is sort of following all of this and gets excited when the Panama Papers come out. And she is revealed as sort of like a mole. She's also playing like a mole inside this law office who is theoretically the source of the Panama mm-hmm. Papers. And she reveals herself in the final scene to be not just, you know, she takes off her wig and sunglasses and is Meryl Streep. And
then Lady Liberty.
Yeah. I mean, it's supposed to be this sort of button on the movie. And I think part of the reason it doesn't work is because all of the short stories don't sort of flow together in the same way, right? There is this, you know, there's one in the middle that's sort of meant to illustrate the shells all the way down thing where a wealthy African expat who's finishing up college in the United States finds out that her father is cheating on her mother with her college roommate, and he tries to buy her off and have her not tell by giving her, I think it's bearer bonds that let her control a company.
Worth $20 million, supposedly.
Yes, and theoretically, her mom has gotten bought off in the same way in the past, and they find out at the end of sort of the short story that he has tricked them, and the shares that they have are worthless. And so it's sort of... that veers away from all of the questions about tax avoidance and shell companies and becomes the story about, you know, what wealth does to people morally, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the father is obviously a bad figure because he thinks he can just buy everyone off and then defraud them. But what does it say about the mother and the daughter mm-hmm. that they're right. willing to accept these kinds of payments?
Right. And this is like kind of the running thread of the film, right? The short stories is that avarice is a universal problem.
Yeah.
And one of the things I actually kind of admired about this movie, almost from a strictly ideological perspective, is the segment on China, with Bo Xilai, and the organ harvesting of the Falun Gong. Yep. Coming back around to that, like there's actually something kind of provocative there, and that is the sort of story that doesn't get told much outside of a Richard Gere essay. And I'm
laundromat kind of, is not going to open in
this
Chinese
is not,
theater.
This is there's an underground movie hut somewhere in China in Beijing that's showing a double feature of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and
the
laundromat, and that person is going to prison.
They're going to a job training center.
He's going to a job training center. But I thought there was something in that kind of like I hate to keep using this term, but Trumpy sense of like the elites of the world are knifing each other and knifing you especially, and they are all profiting from it.
So
somebody sells them out for their own gain.
I still want to resist this idea that it's Trumpy, but Soderbergh has always had a sort of a populist streak. He has always been concerned with ordinary mm-hmm. people and with working class mm-hmm. people. And you can look at even something like Magic Mike, which mm-hmm. is one of his most popular movies, certainly of the last 5 or 10 years since the Ocean's films. And it's really just like it's a big crowd pleaser about a male stripper played by Channing Tatum. But there's this undercurrent, this sort of subplot of like, this is what ordinary life for normal working people in Florida is like. You meet Channing Tatum and the other male stripper, sort of his young protege, when they're working construction jobs, and you find out about the shoes they have to wear and
male
sort of what
working
they expect,
class
right?
anxiety. Right.
You know the The woman who is sort of the love interest in the story is a nurse, and there's sort of talk about, you know, there's sort of a couple of discussions about like Medicaid and insurance and all this stuff that sort of right. Like he just textures that world with a bunch of real stuff that, you know, that ordinary sort of working class middle American people run into all the time that you almost never see in movies. And it's one of the things that Soderbergh brings to films. I think even a quite flawed kind of a failed film like The Laundromat that you just don't see anywhere else. And it's one of the reasons why I think even his bad experiments, I would say that this is one, they're always worth watching and always kind of interesting. And I would just add one more movie to that, to the list of bad experiments that's really interesting, which is Bubble, which is, was one of the very first on-demand films by a major filmmaker. And so it was released day and date in both. You could go see it here at the, I think it played at the E Street, but you could also download it from VOD. This was maybe 10 or 12 years ago. It's not a great movie. It's not very entertaining, but it is a movie about a working class woman at a factory and sort of how, what her life is like. And it's really, it's really a sort of a great example of what Soderbergh is good at. Both he's a technical innovator in terms of not just in terms of filmmaking, but in terms of distribution. And he is someone who wants to make movies about real people, ordinary people, and the lives that are often ignored by Hollywood studios.
I have to say, the Chinese section of the movie, which is in some ways like most unmoored from the specific arguments they're making. I mean, basically it involves a wealthy Chinese woman and her daughter poisoning a businessman who, like, they've been in sort of
a British businessman.
Yeah. And then they're arrested. They think they're going to frame him as part of an anti-corruption crackdown in China, and actually they get arrested. The one thing that I walked away from that segment of the movie thinking is that I would have loved to see the version of Crazy Rich Asians that Steven Soderbergh directed. Because one thing that
yes.
doesn't make it at all from the page in Kevin Kwan's novel to the screen in the movie adaptation of Crazy Rich Asians is this really sort of scabrous look at it, you know, people who live in this hyper wealthy environment. You know, it's incredibly clear in the book that people are incredibly racist, that a lot of folks are corrupt, that there are all sorts of sort of gross compromises and like intra-class distinctions. And Soderbergh would have made a great scabrous version of that movie. And I would love to see that. It would never get made. But it would have been super fun. Mm. He would have done a great job.
So what do we say? Thumbs up or thumbs down on The Laundromat? Alyssa?
I can't recommend that you see it unless you're a Soderbergh completist. So probably thumbs like sideways?
Oh, don't be a squish.
Fine, thumbs down.
Peter. Thumbs down, but if you like weird movies that that are made by Steven Soderbergh and you like Jeffrey Wright and Gary Oldman and Meryl Streep.
And Antonio Banderas.
And Antonio Banderas.
And fantastic menswear. Like, let's be clear. Yeah. Fantastic menswear.
I mean, it's not the worst way to spend 96 minutes of your life if you're interested
short.
In weird movies, but it's not a good movie.
As somebody who is interested in weird movies, I give it a thumbs up. Now we're on to assigned viewing. Up this week, in preparation for Terminator, Dark Fate, a.k.a. that movie with the trailer with the song that's like, I'm going hunting, that I've seen literally 5,000 times this year. I've seen it more times than I care to remember. We thought folks should watch the first two Terminator movies. Despite both being nominally in the same genre, sci-fi, they feel like very different films. The first is kind of a low-budget grindhouse sci-fi, and the second is an epic sci-fi. It ushered in a whole new wave of technological advances at the movie theater and kind of really kicked off a huge, big-budget era of filmmaking. Peter, which do you prefer, grind-fi or sci-epic?
It's really hard to choose. If I have to choose one that I want to watch, most of the time it's going to be Terminator 2. If I have to choose one that I'm a little more impressed with, it's the first one. Mm. And so the first one is, I mean, really just an incredible feat of low-budget entrepreneurial filmmaking. And I don't know if you guys have read the stories about how James Cameron, who had just come off of working on films like Piranha 2, The Spawning for Roger Corman, and Cameron wanted to make his own feature. And of course, he didn't have a lot of resources, but he wanted to make his own sort of sci-fi movie, and he wanted it to be big and successful. And so what he did was he put together a list of the most successful box office, like science fiction genre films that that had existed up to that time, and then like diagrammed them all, pulled out what elements they had, and then made it, and then wrote a screenplay that was like, here's all the successful elements all in one movie. And then he directed the hell out of it. Mm. And that's the other part of it, right? So it's like this kind of fascinating feat of let's figure out what people are going to like, you know, sort of what they already like, what might sell. But look at that movie and look at the resources they had and how incredibly exciting it is. Just crackerjack in terms of pacing, in terms of even the effects work, the early Stan Winston work on the exoskeleton version of the Terminator that appears in the last couple of minutes of the movie. The way the third act is structured with this sort of false ending, which you see again in both Aliens, which was his follow-up, and in Terminator 2. Mm-hmm. And I was actually just sort of... I would disagree a little bit that they feel really different. Obviously, they're very different in scale, but in terms of structure, pacing, and in terms of innovation, right? What he was able to do at both the low budget level and the very large budget level, T2 was one of the first movies to have a $100 million budget, really shows that he's somebody who, like, give him whatever resources you give him, he is going to not just use them well, but do something and try to do something and pull it off that nobody else has ever done before. And that's what really makes those movies, or part of what makes those movies so interesting and so lasting, is that they're total original. I mean, they feel very much like each other, but they're really total originals in a lot of ways. He really pushed the envelope in terms of what you could do with technology and in terms of an action movie structure and pacing.
Alyssa, you had thoughts about Arnold Schwarzenegger in this movie.
It's so interesting to go back and look at just sort of how dewy Arnold Schwarzenegger seems when the Terminator arrives in the present day in the first movie. I mean, he looks as like sort of like he has Chris Evans' skincare regimen. Like, he's just beautiful. And it's fascinating to see also just how his physique, which was so unusual at the time, has become sort of the bare minimum standard for in male action stars today. It's like every movie now needs to have like the arms shot for where you know someone is like holding onto a helicopter and falling off a building or preventing the helicopter from taking off.
And you compare him with Michael Biehn in that movie,
who is
the lead, who is the sort of the handsome guy at the heart of the film, and you see him with his shirt off, and he looks good.
He looks like
a normal guy who exercises.
He looks wiry. He looks like strong but wiry. It was funny, we were kind of discussing this with somebody we all know from Twitter, screenwriter Zach Stentz, who was talking about how like the evolution of the like male physique on film. Like, if you look at, I think the example he used was, what was it, the Netflix show, some Netflix sci-fi show where, you know, a guy gets out of like a regeneration pod or something and he just looks like, you know, a cut from marble, just like a total, just a statuesque guy. And that is like, that's the standard now, like you say. I mean, like, Arnold's thighs are probably a bit bigger in this movie. Than he does not skip leg day. He does not skip leg day, the Terminator. But it is interesting, just as from a like, you know, psychological, physiological phenomenon, but also like, as Zach suggested, there is going to come a steroid reckoning at some point in the Hollywood industry, because this is not natural. This is not real men don't look like this.
I mean, by the time that the Terminator came out, Schwarzenegger had been building. I mean, bodybuilding is called bodybuilding for a reason, right? It is a slow, long process where you get biggest, often in your very late 30s or even early 40s. And by the time that movie came out, Schwarzenegger had been building for probably a couple of decades.
Yeah.
But that was unusual. Yeah, the product of his immersion and the fact that he was coming up in this very specific physical culture. I mean, that's literally what it's called.
Yeah, like Venice Beach or wherever he was.
Yeah. And he was sort of part of the founding of the modern bodybuilding movement out in Venice Beach.
Right. But you said something about, you know, looking at putative male lead. But part of what's so interesting about the Terminator movies is that, you know, Linda Hamilton is the lead in those movies. And the extent to which she just makes off with the first one is so incredible. And I haven't seen Terminator for a long time. And it was very interesting watching it as the mom of a young kid, thinking of it, a story about, like, this is the story of how this person got pregnant, right? Like, that's fundamentally the story of the first movie.
It's a love story.
Yeah,
really.
Well, yeah, but it's also, I mean, the first movie, she is, like, so seeing this person who's presented as, like, dewy and totally innocent become, like, incredibly resourceful and determined, and just see that kind of turn on, and then to have her in the second movie where she is just this destroyed person, in part because no one believes her. It's a really remarkable illustration of range. And I mean, she's talked a lot about her own mental illness and the extent to which it's derailed her career, but just as a sort of two-hander, those two movies are remarkable and would not work without her, I don't think.
Yeah, well, I'm really excited about Dark Fate, in part because it brings her back. But these two movies, and then you add in the two films that Cameron made in between, Aliens and The Abyss, are, like, they're great action movies. And they just work on an action movie level, but they're actually really smart and interesting films about gender dynamics in a way that you, like, it's kind of crazy that three of the best action movies in that era, in the, you know, sort of 80s through early 90s, are James Cameron films that are really about, like, what is asking kind of questions about what masculinity is and whether it's good, and like how sort of how women can how women relate to it and how they should, and like what you talked about the being believed aspect of Hamilton's character in Terminator 2. She is shaped by some of the discussions in some ways that we are, you know, by something that's very similar to a lot of the kind of cultural discussions around men and women today, right?
Yeah.
Is that people didn't believe her when she told a story that was admittedly difficult to believe, but true.
Well, obviously, totally insane from the perspective of a normal person. I mean, let's be honest. That if somebody came up to you and was like, "I have been hunted by a robot from the future, and impregnated by the soldier that my son sent back to knock me up so he could exist." I think that would be a crazy story that none of us would believe.
It's a step beyond Netflix's Unbelievable, which is also actually really good. Toni Collette and Merritt Weaver are amazing in that. But no, I mean, I think James Cameron obviously loves and admires and is just interested in women in a way that few blockbuster directors are.
This is one of the reasons why I find the modern dismissal of True Lies to be kind of infuriating is the wrong word, but kind of amusing, because I understand the, you know, people say it's sexist, whatever. But it is about how a couple comes to terms with their own relationship and their own power dynamics. I would say that True Lies is more about modern masculinity than any of these other movies.
Aliens, man. Aliens, like, all of that stuff at the beginning when they come out of the cryo chambers, right? And, you know, the presentation of Vasquez
traditionally masculine marine stuff.
And then all of, you know, and then Sigourney Weaver sort of setting up a kind of, you know, a fake little family with Newt and with the Michael Biehn character fighting the queen, right? Like, it sort of becomes
the chest bursters are like a perversion of birth, right? I mean,
it's very much a movie about masculinity, and it's really funny, I think, that Cameron did this at the same time that he wrote the screenplay for Rambo 2, which in a lot of ways sort of set the tone for, like, very generic Hollywood masculinity, right? It wasn't ironic. And then in the movies he's directing himself, he is really sort of subverting all of those same ideas and twisting them, and kind of playing with some of the tropes and, you know, about that we think of in terms of 80s action movies.
He's
playing with them and undermining the same ideas that he gave us.
What you are suggesting, kind of, is that femininity is best off when it is expressed in masculine ways.
I didn't say best. I'm just saying that it's very interesting.
You're talking about how it's defining masculinity and feminine. I think it is an interesting series of characters here. I agree, but, like, what kind of unites them all, right, is that it is, you're talking about female characters that act more like men.
I wouldn't quite say
not,
that.
Not in Terminator so much as Terminator 2 and Aliens and True Lies.
I do think that Cameron has, so there are a couple of different ways. I mean, this is a big argument within feminism, right? I mean, is feminism in pop culture best expressed by women doing things that traditionally have been considered the preserve of men? Or is feminism best served by sort of an elevation of feminine values, right? And Cameron does this really interesting synthesis where he suggests that women have as much sort of power and ingenuity and capacity for violence as men, but often roots that in either sort of feminine sexuality, like in Titanic, where that becomes this sort of like driving force for independence and, you know, authenticity, or in, you know, the Alien movies and in the Terminator movies in motherhood, right? So it's this like, he is very interested in celebrating like feminine roles and feminine strength and the role of the mother in particular, but that becomes the way that women sort of get access to the sort of strength and capacity for violence that has traditionally been reserved for men.
All right. We're going to have to move on. Everybody enjoy I'm Going Hunting out this week. Next week, I guess. Make sure to watch it next week.
Terminator Dark
Fate.
Yeah,
that's right. That's right. I can only think of it as that dumb song. Oh God.
It's a remake of The Hunt.
That's it for Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Rebeller. Please go to rebellermedia.com and sign up for a membership. If you don't sign up, we don't get to keep doing this. If you loved it, tell your friends and review us at Apple. We need those reviews. If you didn't love it, complain to me on Twitter at SonnyBunch. I will convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you next week.
Across the Movie Aisle is a Rebeller Podcast Network original, hosted by Sonny Bunch, Alyssa Rosenberg, and Peter Suderman. Produced by Sonny Bunch and Natasha Pasetta. Executive Producer Dallas Sonnier. Associate Producer Jessica Safavamare. Art and Design by Jason Koslerich. Sound Recording, Design, and Mixing by Sonny Bunch, with music by James Malone.